Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of August 8, 2013. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Throughout the month of August, we are interrupting our standard program format to bring you a special summer broadcast dedicated to the ongoing investigation by independent researchers into the attacks of September 11, 2001. During the week marking the 10th anniversary of the attacks popularly referred to as 9/11, experts and researchers from around the world gathered at Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada, to present new and established evidence that questions the official narrative of that event and how it happened. The evidence was directed to a distinguished panel of experts over a four-day period. The speeches you are about to hear were originally recorded, mastered, and assembled in a 330-minute video called The Toronto Hearing on 9/11, Uncovering 10 Years of Deception. A DVD copy of the video is available for purchase at the website globalresearch.ca. Lori Van Auken is the widow of Kenneth Van Auken, who perished in the September 11th attacks. She joined with fellow 9/11 widows Patty Casaza, Kristen Breitweiser, and Mindy Kleinberg to form a group known as the Jersey Girls, who successfully pressured the government into forming a commission of inquiry into the 9/11 attacks. Her videotaped message opened the Toronto hearings on September 8, 2011.
Thank you for continuing on the path to seeking the truth on this 10th anniversary of 9/11 and for inviting me to speak to you. My name is Lori Van Auken. On September 11, 2001, my husband Kenneth went to work at Cantor Fitzgerald in the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Ken was on the 105th floor of Tower 1 when American Airlines Flight 11 hit his building. He left a message that began with, "I love you," and went on to let me know that he had felt the building get hit by something. Ken didn't know if he would get out. Essentially, he was calling to say goodbye. I knew that my husband had survived the initial strike, but that's all I knew. While I sat in utter shock from what I was watching on television, I continued to hope for a glimpse of Ken somewhere in the chaos of people running and jumping from buildings. At some point, President Bush was shown sitting in an elementary school class listening to a story about a pet goat. This footage was in a split screen with a video of the World Trade Center that had smoke billowing from a plane-shaped hole. I clearly remember trying to will Mr. Bush to get up and do something, but even after Andrew Card whispered something in his ear, he just continued to sit there. That was my first clue that something was not quite right. Shouldn't the commander-in-chief have a more important job to do while planes are crashing into the World Trade Center than listening to an elementary school class reading lesson? Wasn't the President of the United States himself a potential terrorist target? I thought of my own kids and worried that the children in that Florida school were in harm's way if President Bush was a target. As I continued watching the most unbelievable drama I had ever seen, the World Trade Center building started crumbling and crashing to the ground. The building that was hit first, my husband's building, remained standing as the South Tower, which was hit second, fell. I thought, how did the South Tower get hit in the top corner of the building without that piece of the building falling away from the rest of the structure as you would expect it to? Suddenly, Ken's building exploded into dust as I watched, and people tried to run away from the gigantic wall of smoke and debris that seemed to follow them down the street. Really? Steel frame skyscrapers could disintegrate just like that? As the news spread, our friends and family members seemed to appear from nowhere to sit with us while we waited for the news about Ken's whereabouts and condition. That first night, I got almost no sleep and made hundreds of phone calls to New York City and New Jersey hospitals, as well as the Red Cross, hoping to find my husband alive somewhere. We didn't find out how much our lives would change until 2 days later, when Howard Lutnick, the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, appeared on TV. That's when we learned that Ken didn't get out, that no one in the building above the impact of the airplane had gotten out alive. The sadness and horror that shrouded my family after September 11th cannot possibly be conveyed to you. Before long, the gnawing question started overwhelming me. I wasn't eating or sleeping very much, and instead, I found myself hunched over my computer in my basement, reading and researching every 9/11 related article that I could get my hands on. Mindy Kleinberg and I live in the same town, and our husbands work for the same company, but we had never met prior to September 11, 2001. Right after the tragedy, a mutual friend introduced us. Mindy and I began attending a support group that the families affected by Pan Am 103 Lockerbie had set up for the 9/11 families. There we met Bob Minetti, who had lost a child in the crash of Pan Am 103. At another meeting for 9/11 victims' family members, we became acquainted with Patty Casaza and Kristen Breitweiser. We began emailing each other about questions we had. Soon we would learn that there would be only a congressional investigation and only into the intelligence failures that led to 9/11. But by then we knew that every governmental agency had failed us on September 11th. NORAD, the FAA, the DOJ, etc. In addition to the FBI, CIA, and NSA. We wanted an investigation into all of the actions and failures that had led to the deaths of our loved ones and so many others on that horrible September day. Many people couldn't, or more likely didn't want, to hear the difficult questions regarding 9/11 that were emerging. But Bob Minetti listened and encouraged us to go to Washington, D.C. to ask for a comprehensive investigation. We learned that there was a stalled bill proposing a 9/11 commission and decided to go and see if we could light a fire under the lawmakers to push forward with the legislation for an inquiry. Asking for an investigation into 9/11 became a full-time job. The four of us planned a rally in Washington, D.C. for June 11, 2001, 9 months after 9/11, to garner support for our cause. When seeking meetings in Washington, you are asked for the name of your organization. Thus, the four of us, Mindy Kleinberg, Patty Casaza, Kristen Breitweiser, and I, became the September 11th advocates. Soon, other victims' family members from other states began referring to us as the Jersey Girls. Before long, the press picked it up as well. Gail Sheehy wrote an article about us called Four 9/11 Moms Battle Bush that told our story and brought public attention to our plight. The group of us that would later become the 12 members of the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Commission had now loosely formed. And we learned to split up in order to meet with as many senators and congressmen as we could on a given visit to Washington. As the final language for a bill that would give us the 9/11 Commission was almost agreed upon, we began to notice a lot of foot dragging. Vice President Dick Cheney had clearly been against having an inquiry from the start and was working behind the scenes to keep things from moving forward. Cheney was often seen on TV with some scary reason for why we couldn't have an investigation into 9/11. One time, while we were all together in Representative Porter Goss's office, Goss got a phone call from Cheney telling him to keep negotiating with us. Goss looked flustered by that phone call, and we were beginning to learn how Washington worked. We finally got fed up with the intense runaround that we were getting, with everyone blaming everyone else for the delay. We couldn't take it anymore and asked Senator Lieberman, Democrat of Connecticut, to organize a meeting with all of the involved parties in one room. And to our surprise, he obliged. During that gathering, it became painfully apparent to everyone that it was the Bush-Cheney White House that was causing the stalemate. As the meeting wore on, and it appeared once again that there wouldn't be an agreement to the terms, all of the 9/11 family members that were in attendance stood up in solidarity, saying that we would not leave without an agreement on the legislation. The press was outside waiting to hear about the outcome, and the White House knew it. That was a critical moment and a turning point for us. Finally, the House passed a version of our legislation for an independent investigation. When the Senate voted on their version of the 9/11 Commission bill, we were invited to Washington to witness the event. As the Senate voted on the 9/11 Commission legislation, we were there cheering. Then we learned about conference committees, where the two houses of Congress would mesh the versions of the legislation that each had voted on. We wanted 2 years for the investigation, but got only 18 months. Initially, only $3 million was allotted, compared with $50 million allotted to investigating the Challenger explosion. We wanted subpoena power for each commissioner, but with pressure from the Bush-Cheney White House, there was an agreement made that would allow subpoena power only if the chair and vice chair, or at least six commissioners, voted for it. This was a political body split between five Democrats and five Republicans. Getting six commissioners to agree to ask for a subpoena would have meant that one person had to jump over to the other side, which was highly unlikely. The commission legislation also gave guidance as to who would appoint the 9/11 commissioners. As per the legislation, President Bush got to choose who would head the commission. His first choice was Henry Kissinger. This news was getting some very negative press. Since Kissinger was informally known as the king of cover-ups, and we had fought long and hard for the creation of an independent investigation into the events of 9/11, this was unacceptable to most of us. Since Kissinger was tapped to head our commission, the family steering committee asked to meet with him in his New York City office. A lot of research was done in preparation for that meeting, and we had learned that Kissinger and associates had some of the Bin Laden family members as their clients. Henry Kissinger didn't want to publicly reveal his client list, but we knew that all of the commissioners were required to do so. After some polite conversation, I felt compelled to ask him directly if he had any Saudi clients or any clients by the name of Bin Laden. After I asked my questions, he spilled his coffee and nearly fell off the couch. We'll never know exactly why, but the next day Kissinger resigned. President Bush then named Tom Kaine, the former governor of New Jersey, as chairman of the 9/11 Commission, which was now taking shape. Various congressional leaders picked the balance of the commissioners. As we did our research, it became clear that all of the members that had been chosen for the commission had some conflict of interest. The first commission hearing was in March of 2003. Unbeknownst to us, our real work was just beginning. As watchdogs of the commission, the next 2 years of our lives were exhausting and exasperating as we battled the White House, Congress, the commission's executive director, Philip Zelikow, and at various times both with and against the 9/11 commissioners themselves on the various issues that arose. We fought along with the commissioners to get more money for the commission, to get an extension of time, to get access to important White House documents, and to get Condoleezza Rice to testify. We battled against the commissioners, trying to get them to subpoena recalcitrant witnesses and agencies, and were outraged when we learned they were using minders in interviews. We tried in vain to get them to fire their conflict-laden executive director, Philip Zelikow, and fought against allowing Bush and Cheney to testify together, in a void, with no transcript and no press. We let them know when they fell short of asking hard-hitting questions. We went to every open hearing, hoping that the commissioners would ask tough questions. I can recall only a few instances during the 12 public hearings that we were actually pleased with the vigor of questioning. As executive staff director of the commission, Philip Zelikow really ran the show, deciding what topics would be covered at the hearings and who would be called to testify. After some cursory research, we found out that in 1995, he and Condoleezza Rice had co-authored a book called Germany Unified and Europe Transformed, A Study in Statecraft. They had worked together in the first Bush White House and had both been members of the second Bush's transition team in 2000-2001. As our intense monitoring of the 9/11 Commission continued, we found that there were even more insidious conflicts surrounding Dr. Zelikow. In his work for President Bush's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, the PFIAB, Zelikow helped write the plans for the Iraq War. The Family Steering Committee immediately put out a press release. Quote, it is apparent that Dr. Zelikow should never have been permitted to be executive staff director of the commission. As executive staff director, his job has been to steer the direction of the commission's investigation, an investigation whose mandate includes understanding why the Bush administration failed to prioritize the al-Qaeda threat. It is abundantly clear that Zelikow's conflicts go beyond just the transition period. The press release went on to request Zelikow's resignation. The 9/11 families, or at least some of us, were hoping for a real investigation with scholars and experts in the appropriate fields and evidence to back up the work. We had wanted true independence from politics. We had fought so hard to get this commission and did not want someone who clearly had huge conflicts of interest to be running the investigation. But unfortunately, that's what we got. 10 years after the 9/11 attacks, the old questions still linger and new ones have arisen. A real investigation into 9/11 has never been done. This is incredible considering the direction that we have taken as a country. The passing of the Patriot Act, entering two wars, and our entire foreign policy has all been based on the official account of 9/11. The proper place for the 9/11 proceedings would be a courtroom with subpoena power, rules for swearing in witnesses, and established protocols for handling questioning, cross-examination, and evidence. And ultimately, one would hope, real accountability for the actions that led to the deaths of so many. I want to thank you all for taking the time to gather together on this 10th anniversary in order to explore the issues and continue asking the questions that have never been answered regarding the events of September 11, 2001.
Barbara Honegger is a former White House policy analyst and a senior military affairs journalist with the Naval Postgraduate School. The focus of her September 9th talk was eyewitness accounts and evidence that explosions rather than an airplane strike were responsible for damage at the Pentagon.
The title of my presentation today is Eyewitnesses and Evidence of Explosives at the Pentagon. The official story, as represented in the 9/11 Commission report, is that it was a surprise Pearl Harbor-like attack, which was claimed to be a kamikaze plane attack, on the west outer wall of the Pentagon by Arab Muslim terrorists, who, it is alleged, were in control of Flight 77, a large commercial 757 airliner, and the claim is at exactly 9:37 and 46 seconds, it diagonally penetrated through three of five rings to the inside of the middle ring only, causing a single exit hole on the inside of the middle C ring. The west side of the Pentagon, the official story claims that Flight 77 came in at an oblique angle and did not hit the building straight on, but came in at an oblique angle. And parts of the plane, at least, it is claimed, went all the way through 310 feet. And according to Donald Rumsfeld, he made the claim that the nose of the plane poked itself out of the inside of the middle or C ring. The first claim is that it was a surprise Pearl Harbor-like attack. But the Pentagon, I now know from interviewing eyewitnesses, expected a terrorist attack on the building that morning, but with explosives of some kind. Bomb-sniffing dog teams were at the Pentagon Metro stop at least as early as 7:30 a.m. I've personally interviewed a Fort Monmouth TDY auditor named Michael Nielsen, as well as the very famous Army area survivor April Gallup, for 2 hours with under oath testimony on videotape. And they both stated that there were bomb-sniffing dog teams in the Metro stop at approximately 7:30 that morning, and then they left the Metro stop and presumably they were still there. So the Pentagon expected some kind of an attack, apparently with explosives that the dog teams were sniffing for that moment. We have pretty good idea from one of the 9/11 Commission staff reports, the Team 8 report, which was the one that investigated the response, or I would say non-response, of NORAD on the morning of 9/11 and anything connected with the Pentagon. And they did an interview, many interviews, but one of them, and it's now released, you can see this entire report on the web from the National Archives release, that Captain Leidig, who on the morning of 9/11 was the acting head of the Military Command Center, quote, had no awareness of American Airlines 77 coming back to Washington, D.C. His first awareness of any problem was a call from Rumsfeld's own three-star aide, that's a very high-level officer, who asked Leidig if he, Leidig, felt the explosion in the building and asked Leidig to investigate it. Now, here's another big hint. The FBI's official 9/11 investigation code name is Pent Bomb. Interestingly, the Pent Bomb code name and the translation of the B-O-M in the code name for the word bombing was just the other day confirmed again by FBI Director Robert Mueller in Time magazine just this May 9th. The FBI's SIOC Strategic Operations Center filled to capacity on 9/11 and remained that way through Pent Bomb, the FBI's cryptonym for Pentagon, Twin Towers, and bombing. Now, that's very fascinating because the official story, of course, in the 9/11 Commission report and all the media that follows their lead is that bombs really weren't involved at the World Trade Centers or the Pentagon. There is, in fact, major damage and deaths in the innermost A and B rings of the Pentagon in the West Section. For instance, in the A ring, I did, again, going back to the interview I did with Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations on 9/11, former top Army Green Beret officer Robert Andrews. He told me, quote, "My aide and I had to walk over dead bodies on the inside of the A ring." And then we have Lisa Burgess, just one other example, Stars and Stripes reporter. She said, "I was walking on the Pentagon's innermost corridor across the courtyard when the incident happened. I heard two loud booms, one large, one smaller, and the shockwave threw me against the wall." A Marine major to the Washington Post, that Post article shortly after 9/11, The B-ring between the fourth and fifth quarters was decimated. Now, the B-ring is just second in from the inner courtyard. It's a whole ring in from the C-ring. And we've already seen there were dead bodies and damage in the A-ring as well, just inside the courtyard. The B-ring between fourth and fifth quarters was decimated. The heat was so intense you couldn't go in. Marine major to the Washington Post. The Pentagon Rescue Team, testimony on 9/11. Quote, when we got into the building, we started to feel the heat right away, and as we walked deeper down the hallways, deeper means, and I've confirmed this with many people who work in the Pentagon, deeper means deeper towards the center, towards the courtyard, away from the alleged impact point. Further towards the center, it was just fire everywhere. Not so much smoke there, but fire all around us. You couldn't see the plane, just debris wherever you looked. Now, the C-ring is where the official story says the nose or some heavy part of the plane popped, just barely popped through the inside of the middle or C-ring. But there is good evidence that that inner C-ring famous exit hole was also made by some kind of explosives, probably shaped charge explosives that were put on the wall. This is one of many photographs that were originally from the Department of Defense that are available on the web. Mechanical engineer Michael Meyer has stated categorically, I'll give you his exact quote in a minute, that a round, clean, so-called, in quotes, exit hole is like the one seen here, the inside of the C-ring, is the signature of a shaped charge explosive and definitely cannot be, he said it was impossible, from an impact from any kind of plane debris, nose, heavy piece, otherwise. Meyer spent years in aerospace, structural design, and the design and use of shaped charge explosives. He quote, it is physically impossible for the C-ring wall, the so-called exit hole, to have failed due to the impact of plane debris of any kind in a clean, neat circle like that. There was an oblique or diagonal impact on the outside of the outer wall of the west side, and that diagonally impacting plane and or parts of it after the first part of the penetration, this is the official story, penetrated through only three of the five rings. If a plane or any object, any impactor, would come in at an oblique angle, which the official story says, and goes diagonally through three rings, that you're not going to have a perfectly round exit hole. If it's the front of a fuselage or even a round engine, it would have to impact coming perpendicular to the wall. The official story, of course, says that there is a single exit hole on the inside of the C-ring, caused by whatever. Well, in fact, this is a graphic taken from the Washington Post immediately after 9/11 from Pentagon sources, DOD sources itself. And when you come up afterwards, you can see the key, if you can't see it there, but there are three exit holes listed from the Pentagon's own immediate sources to the Washington Post after 9/11, not just one. This is an aerial photograph that the Pentagon provided to all the media right after 9/11. You can see it on the web. This is the so-called official exit hole right here. But there are two others that, in turn, perfectly match these three so-called exit holes from the Pentagon's own release data. And here it says exit holes, plural. April Gallick, a very famous witness. I have done a two-hour under oath videotaped interview of April Gallick. In that under oath two-hour sworn statement to me, she states, and I'm summarizing, of course, there were huge explosions the second that she, April Gallick, hit the on button on her computer in the E-ring. She said, I thought it was a bomb. There were two explosions. She walked out of the alleged entrance hole, according to the official story, and yet saw no plane, no plane parts, no seats, no passenger, no luggage, no smell of jet fuel, no jet fuel fire, no burns on her body. The only fires she saw were seen coming out of the computers in a large ring around her large Army work area. April Gallick walked out of the alleged entrance hole, according to the official story, with only one shoe, one barefoot, and the floors were not hot, she said, and her soles, as you will see now, are completely unburned. April Gallick resting on the Pentagon lawn after walking out of the alleged impact hole with one barefoot and her soles completely unburned. Lieutenant Kevin Schaefer, the entire command center, he's referring to the Naval Command Center, The entire Naval Command Center, which was in the West Wedge first floor, exploded in a gigantic orange fireball. I felt myself being slammed to the deck by a massive and thunderous shockwave. Additional witnesses and evidence to inside explosives. Army Fort Monmouth Auditor Michael Nielsen, I've mentioned him before, hundreds raced down the hall past me and out the south side exit shouting, "It's a bomb, bomb, it's a bomb." And multiple witnesses smelled cordite, which is definitely not jet fuel, doesn't smell anything like it. Inside explosives would explain why there was no advanced siren or evacuation, which was one of the complaints in April Gallup's lawsuit against Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Myers. The Naval Command Center was almost certainly targeted. The Washington Post said so immediately after 9/11. We know the part that was targeted. It was the intelligence center in this upper corner, which is, this is taken from here. That's that corner right there, and that's that corner, the intelligence cell. Outside terrorists would have targeted the Pentagon roof, obviously, and easier to hit command areas, for instance, where Rumsfeld and Myers worked. Not the National Command Center, or the Naval Command Center, not the CNO Intel plot, which is another apparently targeted offices, or even the sparsely populated entire West Wedge, where the official story says that a plane impacted at almost ground level, because that's precisely the one side of the five sides of the building, the approaches to the building, that had the most physical obstacles in the way. A hill, an antenna, light pole, cyclone fence, and large cable spools that are in advance. The government lied about inside explosions. Do you think it's telling the truth about the one and most famous outside explosion in the five famous frames from the two videotapes of the security cameras in the parking lot of the Pentagon that the videotapes were released in the Mousawi trial in August of 2006? Probably not. And in fact, we know not. And how do we know not? It's the wrong date. Has anyone ever noticed that security camera video says September 12th, and it's also the wrong time. Now, it is important to know that that is one of the five famous leaked frames. Those were leaked in early 2002, and the Mousawi trial didn't release the videos of which these five famous frames were taken in one of the two videos that were close to each other in the parking lot until the Mousawi trial in 2006. Okay, so what we do know is that the wrong date is on the leaked slides, which we do know that these five slides or these five frames came from one of those two security camera videotapes in the parking lot that were released 4 years later in the Mousawi trial. But when they were released in the Mousawi trial, there is no date. The 85 videos that were confiscated by the FBI, there was an FOIA request. The FBI FOIA officer was honest and did an analysis of those 85 videotapes and came back to the person who requested it, just a regular citizen like you and me, who we can all put in FOIA requests. And the analysis came back from the FBI itself that there were only two of the 85 that in any way could be interpreted as showing an impact on the building. And those are the two. And we know that they do not prove anything. They have the wrong time stamp, the wrong date stamp, and they do not show a plane.
You're listening to a special summer broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on participating community radio stations across Canada. We are also heard on the Progressive Radio Network and our podcast at globalresearch.ca. Paul Zaremka is a professor of economics at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Since 1977, he has been the editor for General Research into Political Economy. He is the author of the book Toward a Theory of Economic Development and editor of Frontiers in Econometrics. He's also author of the 2008 book, The Hidden History of 9/11. In his talk, he discussed the evidence of insider trading in American and United Airlines stock, suggesting U.S. intelligence foreknowledge.
The 9/11 9/11 Commission report did deal briefly with the issue of insider trading. So they have an answer to the allegations made that there was substantial insider trading before 9/11. Insider trading is taking advantage of knowledge that you have privately. It's not public information. It's private information that you have about a forthcoming event, and you engage in some kind of financial transaction which will enable you to profit from that forthcoming event that other people don't know about. Sometimes insider trading is called informed trading. You see it both ways. For about 1 month after 9/11/2001, there was reports in mainstream financial press of huge profits being made on the 9/11 event by foreknowledge of the events. Okay, one of the key statements being made referred to using put options. A put option is in the so-called option markets. Okay, you don't actually purchase a stock, you don't sell a stock or anything like that. You purchase an option to do something with a stock. You purchase the option for a specific period of time to be able to, in the case of a put option, to be able to put the stock for sale at a specified price in the, let's say, the next 6 weeks. The option of selling these stocks, let's say, by any time before October 20th at the designated put price. For example, and again, I'm putting this on a screen on the right-hand side. It so happens that American stock and United stock had almost the same price, just by accident, before 9/11, namely around $30. If you knew that 9/11 was going to happen on September 3rd, 4th, or whatever, you could go to a financial firm and buy an option to sell United or American stock, let's say $30, anytime until October 20th. And you know, or you think you know, that the stock is going to go down. When it comes to, let's say, September 16th or 18th or whatever, okay, you can decide to buy the stock if you don't already have it. You buy American Airlines, and the same day, same hour, same second, you sell it. You're buying it, if you're looking at the screen now, you're buying it at under $20, and you had that option to sell it at 30, you made $10. Buying put options costs you money itself, of course, right? I mean, it's not free. It might cost you a dollar. It might cost you $2. Open interest tells you at the end of a day or in the middle of a day or whatever of how many contracts there are out there for a specific strike price for a specific expiration day. The level of open interest changes from three factors. First of all, people buying put options. That's obvious. That's what I've already described. You buy a put option. But you can also sell a put option. I could buy a put option. I could sell. You could say, I want it. You could pay me a price and I'll sell it to you. That's a sale of a put option. Okay? Unfortunately, the data most of us that's publicly available doesn't tell you the difference between my buying a put option and you're selling the put option. You can also exercise the put option. In other words, I bought a put option on American Airlines on September 4th, I can decide, oh, I made a mistake. I mean, it's going to go the wrong way or you know, whatever. And I can decide on September 7th to exercise the option. That means that open interest now will decline at the end of the day. Quintel will tell you how much of whatever variable you are investigating has occurred up to a certain point. A quintel of 99 tells you that 99 out of 100 cases have already occurred and one is yet to come. We have three econometric studies, one of which was published 5 years ago, the second of which was published just a few months ago, and the third of which is not even submitted for publication, but will be submitted very shortly. These are done by econometricians addressing the issue about whether there could be insider trading or informed trading before 9/11. First of all, he looks at the change in the open interest, and I'm going to focus on American and United stocks. He looks at the change in open interest on American and United stocks for a very short period, September 5th to December 10th. And he looks at the change in open interest, which I've told you about, for those four trading days, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 10th. He's looking at four trading days, looking at the change in open interest for those days. He compares that with a benchmark period of 126 trading days before that to see whether they are unusual. For that stock, he compares it to 1,000 pieces of data on the 1,000 largest corporations between January 2nd, 1990 to September 4th, 2001 to get this frequency distribution I was referring to, and therefore to be able to get this idea of where the quintels are for the transactions that are occurring in put options for American and United Airlines. That result would only have occurred on September 10th for American Airlines 1% of the time. There was 99 out of 100 cases. You would not have seen on September 10th what you actually did observe on September 10th. He inferred from that 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 was evidence of informed or insider trading on American Airlines on September 10th. He looks at spikes in put option trading on 14 companies over a 10-year period. And after all the statistical stuff that's summarized here, they find that there are only 37 in all of that 10-year period for 14 stocks. There's only 37 events to be identified as possibly informed or insider trading, whatever word you prefer to use. Only 37. They're not focusing on 9/11, but it's in the period of 9/11. The frequency that such a value occurred based upon, and then they look at the two-period prior history of that day. They look back 2 years for that stock option over 2 years and see, well, was that particularly unusual or not? For example, American, and they cite American on September 10th had occurred at that level or more only five prior times in prior 2 years. They find out that out of the 37 cases that they are able to identify, 33 out of the 37 actually occurred before a real event, which was realize you're dealing with something prior to an event. So how would you know, unless you have inside information, that that event is going to happen? Okay? 33 out of 37 cases have to do with a subsequent event. Only four does not have to do with it, that they can identify it as doing with a subsequent event. 13 of the 33 center around 9/11. The 9/11 Commission report says it did a careful investigation of what I've just been talking about, namely insider trading in put options on American Airlines and on United Airlines. Okay? And it says for these two stocks before 9/11, we found no evidence of insider trading in spite of the fact that it seems to be suspicious. These papers are not contested, to the best of my knowledge. Therefore, I accept this econometric research as meritorious. And that's what I'm recommending to the panel. You accept these econometric studies as meritorious. I'm standing here before you as an econometrician, as a scientist, okay? And I'm making a statement about the government failing to follow scientific evidence. But it's not like, you know, physical evidence about the World Trade Centers. It's a different kind of evidence. It's evidence about put option trading and that kind of, you know, this is evidence. And this is, I mean, I'm not speculating on something here. I'm only talking about evidence.
Jay Kolar is a freelance writer and film studies instructor. He contributed to Sarenka's book, The Hidden History of 9/11, and spoke on September 9th, day two of the Toronto hearings, on the flaws in the official account of what was known about the alleged 9/11 hijackers.
The U.S. government's story, upon close examination of the evidence, of which I'm only going to be able to present a small segment today, reveals an accumulation of flaws. We begin with the FBI's initial list of hijackers, which should have been released concurrently with the flight manifests that were never released after the FBI had quickly confiscated them. The FBI said it had located its suspects from those manifests, not to be mistaken for the passenger lists made available by the airlines, which contained none of the 19 names. But within 24 hours, CNN had acquired this first FBI list from U.S. Customs, and one of the relevant customs officials is Robert Bonner. But it contained five names, a Moziar Kanid on Flight 77, and four others, Adnan Bukhari, Amir Bukhari, Amir Kamfar, and Abdul Rahman Alomari. From the Flight 11 manifest, names that the FBI dropped and replaced with Walid Anwa'il al-Sheri, Satam el-Sukami, and Abdul Aziz al-Amari. Logically, that would mean that there should have been, including the name of Mohammed Atta on that first Flight 11, who had not been replaced by a substitute, at least nine Arab names from which to choose. But there weren't. Since none of the airline lists, which only contain passengers minus hijacker names, contain any of those Arab names, which were changed by the FBI, were changes the FBI had implemented, therefore tampering with crime scene evidence. It is important to note that reputable documented sources verified that at least nine of the FBI's second and final list of 19 were still alive after 9/11. The U.S. government's best evidence, which you will see is actually the worst evidence of hijackers, the Dulles Airport video. Compare that the Dulles video still to a Portland Jetport video still on the left. The only other video we have of the alleged boarding planes on 9/11 was the one from the Portland Jetport, where in the frame on the left, Atta and Aziz al-Amari proceeded to board a connecting flight, not the Flight 11 that crashed. While this disqualifies it as evidence of a flight that crashed, it does show the verifiable airport security data, which continues throughout the video's duration, the date, digital ongoing time of day, and the closed circuit TV identification number, which reveals the camera's location. Such data on the still from the Dulles Airport video, on the other hand, which is on the right, is the first of six major problems we have with it. Unlike the Portland video, and unlike every other airport surveillance video we've seen, it lacks verifiable authenticity, which can only come from imprinted security data, the date, the digital ongoing clock, and camera number. Thus, lacking imprinted security data on the entire tape, standard for all airport videos, and without evidence to indicate erasure, there is no possibility that the Dulles video is authentic. Hence the probability that is a forgery. Devoid of such security data, both as a security video and as evidence of an event to be used in a court of law, what possible use could this video have? Located at an airport security checkpoint, a security camera that records without imprinting security data is completely suspect. The presence of Salam al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar allegedly preparing to board Flight 77 introduces the second problem. Both he and al-Midhar turned up still alive after 9/11. In Al-Midhar's case, one report comes from the FBI itself, which warned all banks to watch for him after 9/11. It took 3 years for the original release of the Dulles Airport video in 2004. In a heavily edited, and they only showed heavily edited versions of between 57 seconds and 150, well, 2.5 minutes in duration, out of a possible 22 minutes from first to last alleged hijacker. The overall difficulty in viewing these versions made available to the public is that they contain only a mere fraction of the approximately 22 minutes of this Dulles footage that's going by the commission's noting that the time of arrival of the first alleged hijackers, the pair, and the arrival of the last pair. The bin Laden confession video forgery, I'm just going to mention this briefly. It's everybody who's seen it can see that the guy in it wasn't him. The major proof the Bush administration touted to incriminate bin Laden, hijackers, and al-Qaeda, this bin Laden that appeared in the so-called bin Laden confession video, was a rotund, jolly bin Laden imposter who praised the five great martyrs who turned up alive after 9/11. However, inaccuracies and distortions of White House and Pentagon translations from the Arabic went unreported in American press. Saudi experts and German investigators alike have found these translations manipulative and misleading American people. Correctly translated, the bin Laden video, far from providing proof to support the official story, actually discredits itself and the official story. Of the JR photographs released through the media, the 1999 Lebanese passport with a circular ink stamp, these are the real Ziajira. His 1999 Lebanese passport on the left, especially clear photo representative of all but one other photograph, which is the US visa photograph, one third burnt away, that was recovered from the wreckage. That passport photo shows marked differences from the rest. The nose and cheeks are full with higher, well-defined cheekbones, and the hair is wavy. Another factor which calls the authenticity of the paper passport photo of Jera into question is its miraculous survival after the black box was never found and most of United Airlines' 93 flight wreckage was either reduced to ashes or blown to bits or ground to a pulp. He was born Sunni, but educated in Christian schools. He grew up in a well-to-do secular environment. He had dozens of friends, classmates, instructors, family, and landlords. They were all interviewed, and they all testified he was apolitical, non-religious, more a jet-setter than a jet pilot, well-liked, outgoing, friendly, and loved to party. A friend who once led him to mosque, Abdul Rahman al-Makadi, called Jarrah a, quote, weak Muslim, unquote. Finally, all his Florida flight school classmates avoided flying with Jarrah when the word got out that he was a lousy pilot, student pilot. The U.S. government has never provided a flight manifest or any other evidence to show Jarrah ever boarded. Replete with innuendo, hearsay, forged documents, and fabrications, the official legend of Jarrah's U.S. stay deviates significantly from the facts and eyewitness accounts and uses media complicity to distort his character.
Michel Chossudovsky is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa and an award-winning author. He heads the Center for Research on Globalization and is the author of several books on geopolitics, including America's War on Terrorism and The Globalization of Poverty in the New World Order. On day two of the hearings, he reviewed his own research of al-Qaeda as a U.S. intelligence asset and spoke to the implications of 9/11 to the larger U.S. and global military doctrines.
What I'd like to address in my presentation are the broad consequences of 9/11 with regard to U.S. military doctrine, but more broadly, the pretext and justification which the lies surrounding 9/11 have given to waging a war of conquest under the banner of what we call the war on terrorism, or the global war on terrorism. The global war on terrorism was launched late at night by the war cabinet, which was formed in the afternoon of 9/11. And a decision was taken to declare war on Afghanistan as a state sponsor of the 9/11 attacks, in other words, a sovereign country somewhere in Central Asia, on the grounds that Al-Qaeda and mastermind Osama bin Laden was behind these attacks, and consequently, Afghanistan as hosting Al-Qaeda was responsible for a military attack on the United States of America. And what is more important is that the following morning, without any evidence, nobody knew who had done it at, you know, on the same day. But the following morning, Eastern European time in Brussels, the Atlantic Alliance met and invoked Article 5 of the Treaty of Washington, which essentially states that an attack on one of its members constitutes an attack on all of its members under the concept of collective defense. Now, immediately we see unfolding this notion of preemptive war, that this was an act of defense, and as a result, NATO didn't actually declare war on the 12th. It waited until barely two or three days before, based on some State Department document which was composed and never verified, and then they said, yes, we now rubber stamp the decision that we took tentatively on September the 12th. But needless to say, this tragic event of 9/11 was used as a pretext and justification to wage war on an impoverished country in Central Asia. There were diplomatic exchanges between Afghanistan and the United States. People say the Taliban, but this was the government of Afghanistan, whether we like them or not. And they sent, I think, on two occasions, if there's evidence that bin Laden is behind these attacks, we'd be happy to hand him over to American justice. And George W. Bush said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. That was his response. So that avenue was not taken. And anybody who has a minimal understanding of military planning will know that you don't plan a large-scale theater war in a matter of 4 weeks. This conference took several months to prepare. And imagine, anybody who has looked at military documents knows that it takes several months and sometimes years to prepare a war of that size. So that the war on Afghanistan was in the pipeline well before 9/11. Al-Qaeda and his leader Osama bin Laden constitute the outside enemy in the eyes of public opinion. And we saw that in the wake of these tragic events, immediately there was a mass mobilization of public opinion. And I don't think even sectors in Canada, I think everybody joined the bandwagon, virtually everybody, even trade unions, progressive organizations, and a few dissenting voices. If Al-Qaeda is behind these attacks, who is behind Al-Qaeda? And I knew from the research I'd conducted on Yugoslavia in particular, but going back to the Soviet-Afghan war, that Al-Qaeda was an intelligence asset of the CIA. And this was amply recognized in numerous documents. And the response of the U.S. intelligence community was, we supported him, but he went against us. Okay, you can read that. I'm quoting literally from press reports, from intelligence reports. It's when an intelligence asset goes against his sponsor. Now, we were the sponsors of Al-Qaeda. It was for a good cause. It was to fight the communists in the Soviet-Afghan war, and we sent in the Mujahideen. We trained them in these CIA camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We set up the religious schools, the madrasas. We then contracted with our friends in Saudi Arabia to send in Wahhabi missions into Afghanistan to train these people. The understanding of the intelligence community is he turned against us. In the wake of the Cold War, the jihad then started to target the Western world, and that 9/11 was an attack by Muslim terrorists. Now, the blowback, I can tell you that the blowback is a fabrication. Bin Laden's whereabouts have always been known. Why? Because Al-Qaeda is a CIA intelligence asset and has always been an intelligence asset and continues to be an intelligence asset. So there is no blowback. And I will argue that there's a blow forward. We see Al-Qaeda in Iraq, then we see Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in Africa. We had subsidiaries of Al-Qaeda virtually everywhere, you know. And wherever the United States needed to intervene militarily, they used the pretext of Al-Qaeda in Yemen or Somalia or wherever, under different names, and of course, corroborated by media reports, etc. And in all cases, I can assure you, these are instruments of U.S. intelligence or MI6 or Mossad. And there's a collaboration between them. 9/11 has unleashed a roadmap of war and destruction. We are at the most serious, we are at the crossroads of the most serious crisis in modern history. I think that's not an understatement. And the war on terrorism is part of that process because it gives a justification to wage war on humanitarian grounds, so that you wage the war not against countries, but against what they called non-state entities, which came again into the jargon. All this has permeated the consciousness of millions of people. It's created an atmosphere of fear and intimidation, which was then coupled with the coded alert, the color-coded alerts. And Homeland Security, and so on, and it was a pretext to wage a war without borders, which in essence is a war of conquest, and it was also a pretext to implement far-reaching changes at home through the Patriot legislation, through national security, protection of borders, and so on, so forth. Ultimately, If the war on terrorism is no longer accepted and doesn't have its legitimacy, the whole construct of military doctrine collapses like a deck of cards. And that's why 9/11 truth is so important.
On today's program, we heard presentations from 9/11 widow and activist Lori Van Alken, former White House policy analyst Barbara Honegger, economics professor Paul Zaremka, freelance writer Jay Kolar, and global research director Professor Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's presentations are all from a 330-minute DVD entitled The Toronto Hearings on 9/11, Uncovering 10 Years of Deception. Copies of the video are available for purchase at the website globalresearch.ca. The Toronto Hearings on 9/11 and Uncovering 10 Years of Deception was presented by the International Center for 9/11 Studies in collaboration with Press for Truth. It was produced by Stephen Davies, Dan Dix, and Brian Law. Music was by Dan Dix. The executive producer was James Gourley. Producer and host of the Global Research NewsHour is me, Michael Welch. Please be sure to join us next week for part 3 of this special summer series.